Digital Flotsam is made possible by the generous support of the Robert Wood Johnson Company, makers of prosthetic Wood Johnsons for more than half a century, because nothing feels better than wood.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Digital Flotsam. I am your host, P.W. Fenton. This episode is a special one in a couple of ways. First, it'll feature a guest storyteller, something that has only happened a few times in the history of this show. And second, it will be the first Digital Flotsam not associated with Mevio, formerly known as Podshow. Digital Flotsam's contract with Mevio has expired, and I'm moving on. This show will come to you from my own server and will contain no ads from Mevio advertisers. Not that I don't want to have an income from my work. If anybody knows anyone at all who would like to be part of supporting this show, please hook me up. I'm in the book. My goal is to get Digital Flotsam into broadcast radio, and not only on the internet. So help me out if you think your local public radio station might be interested in a show like Digital Flotsam. Let them know. Hopefully, most of the listeners of Digital Flotsam are subscribed to the feed I started way back in 2005, the address of which is digitalflotsam.org/rss.xml. I believe that there is possibly another feed generated by Mevio that will soon cease to exist. Please check and make sure you are subscribed to the original feed. If you have any doubt, you can easily visit the Digital Flotsam blog or the original Digital Flotsam website at digitalflotsam.org and click on the links to subscribe. You can also subscribe through iTunes and it'll go to my feed. So let's get on with the show. This Digital Flotsam is a special one and it's called Like Tears in Rain.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
I had an interesting thing happen to me recently. An internet acquaintance of mine named Rich Fraser sent me a message complimenting me on my new podcast called On This Day in Blues History. It's a show, as the name implies, that each day looks at events that occurred in the history of blues music on that date in the past. He closed the message by suggesting that he could help me if I needed something for December 10th. And of course, made me a little curious about the reference, so I sent him a message back asking him what was significant about that date. I don't recall exactly what his reply was, except that I learned It was the day that he lost his father as a child. Intrigued as to why this event would relate to what I was doing with my new podcast, I began to investigate. Some people mistakenly believe that I am a vast storehouse of knowledge. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, I have a terrible memory, but what I do have is a knack for online research. I feel like if it's out there, I can find it. Well, anyone that has tried to carry on an email conversation knows that it can be frustratingly slow and filled with long periods of silence. Being an impatient man, I decided that while I was waiting for a reply from Rich, I would do a little sleuthing to see if I could figure out how this date and his father passing could possibly relate to my show. Slowly, over many hours, I began to piece together the facts that make up this story, and I was deeply moved by what I uncovered. Most of all, by the sad fact that the story of Rich's dad had been sort of lost in the larger circumstances of his passing. I actually felt a little hurt by it. All the more so when I stumbled upon a video Rich had posted on YouTube where he was alone, flying a small plane, on the anniversary of his dad's death and paying tribute to his late parents by dropping a couple of roses near the place his father died. Now, I'm not going to reveal at this point the circumstances I discovered that overshadowed his father's death. But I decided right then and there that this was a wrong that had to be righted, and a story that had to be told. I got in touch with Rich, and I asked him to please tell his father's story to the listeners of Digital Flotsam. The recording quality isn't as good as I would have liked it to be, but I managed to record Rich talking about his dad via Skype.
My father was a New York City boy. From everything that I can tell, and I don't know too much about his early life. He was born in 1941 as an only child. His father left the picture fairly early in his life. I'm not exactly sure when, but I think it was sometime around his teens. From everything I can tell, he had a pretty normal childhood. He was mechanically inclined, as a lot of young men were back in the day. He got into sprint car racing. He liked to do his own work. I'm not sure what track he might have raced at. I know there was a track out in Islip in the day. Went through high school. I think it was Valley Stream North High School. Graduated, it seems, without a whole lot of difficulty, but it was pretty clear that he was not destined for college. But from everything I remember about life back in those days, you didn't necessarily need to go to college to get ahead in life as such. You could still go out and get a trade somewhere. Or you could go into the Air Force or the military, one of the branches of the military, which is what my father did. So my father entered the Air Force after graduation from high school, not exactly knowing, what year that was. I guess it might have been around 1959 or so. And he went through training as a B-52 combat crew member. I was born in December of 1963. And far as I can tell, picking up from my father's first logbook, he started flying, and that's the sound of the page turning. He started flying in February of 1965. Now, obviously, the story about how he got interested in aviation is lost. I have no idea how that happened, but it's clear that once he started training, and this was at Griffiths Air Force Base in New York, which I believe is also where he was stationed at the time I was born, so at least he was there for a couple of years. Then, probably more so than now, each Air Force base had a flying club. And so, at these flying clubs, it would be a mixture of both the professional, the jet jockeys, bomber pilots, whatever the professional crews they had, where I'm sure they were keeping their planes. And there may have been some kind of a sharing arrangement. where you know, some of the folks who own their own planes may have kind of leased them back or lent them to the flying club so that others could fly them. But he started his lessons in February and you know, quickly made his way through all the required training. I don't know what the requirements were back then, but he eventually earned his private pilot certificate. But it was clear from the beginning that with all the entries in the logbooks was that he piled on the hours just as fast as he could, which was every indication that once he caught this flying bug, he knew right there that that was going to be his next profession.
Rich's dad not only got the flying bug while working around all these Air Force pilots, but he began to realize that flying was also going to be a career opportunity, and he began acquiring the skills he would need to take up flying as a profession.
Once he got his private certificate, then he went and earned his instrument rating and then ultimately his multi-engine rating. He became a certified flight instructor, instrument. He had all the ratings, you know, that even today it's the same path that an aspiring pilot would go through today to get a job in corporate aviation, to go through and get all the ratings, because that's also how you build all of your hours, because in order to get a job in with the airlines, you know, they look at that at your logbooks and say, okay, you've got this many hours, and so on. So even through the time when he transferred from Griffiths down to Robbins Air Force Base was his next tour of duty in Georgia, which was just outside of Macon. I can imagine that by the time he got down there, he was already planning for his separation from the Air Force, and he continues flying, it looks like, and instructing. He's flying Cessna 150s and the new 152, which I think just came out around that time, Cessna 172s. There's a Beech T-34 in there, which is another kind of Beechcraft's training aircraft at the time. So he continues to do that until you get a little bit farther along in the spring. One of the most, or the vivid memory that I have of my father was the day that he took me to the airport. I had a chance to get aboard his boss's aircraft and have a look around it and, you know, scooching up and down in it and sitting in a couple of the seats looking up the cockpit. And I'm sure I was absolutely amazed, as I continue to be to this very day, of going in and looking at airplanes and looking at the panels and saying, geez, would it be nice to fly this thing? I know I had that feeling back then. And I was pretty impressed. You know, it had little curtains on the windows. You know, these the Beech 18 was the executive transport of the day, before corporate jets really made their appearance. It was planes like that that served as corporate transport. And the plane had just been purchased probably just weeks before that. I think they had had that plane, it seems, about 4 or 5 months before the accident. And in fact, I've gone back in the logbooks, and I can kind of put together a sequence of events where my father test flew a number of different aircraft, both Beech of that model, the Beech 18, and others. Some twin-engine Cessnas were listed in there as well. So it was obviously it was rather obvious to me that he began working for him quite a few months before the accident, probably as early as May, by. What I can deduce, at least, and I don't know if I'm too far off on that. But, you know, getting back to that plane, I remember being aboard that plane and walking around it. But then the other memory, the much more vivid memory, and it stays with me to this day, especially since I got into flying. I don't know if too many days go by where I don't think about that time when he lifted me up into what I probably believe to be a Cessna 150. And we took off and we went flying, and I'm sure it was just a flight around the patch. I don't think it was a very long flight at all. It was probably possible that I might have asked that he go ahead and land, because I'm sure at some point I was probably getting a little sick to my stomach. But to this day, I remember when he looks over to me and he offered me the controls, and I was absolutely petrified. I said, "No, Dad, I can't possibly, you know." Who knows if I touch those things and all the thing, all of a sudden it just does a wing over and we go down in a smoking heap. But it was that day that stood with me, is my most vivid memory of the man. And I don't remember anything after that. So I can imagine, or I could probably suspect that it wasn't a whole lot longer after that when we lost him.
Rich was just turning 4 years old at this time, so other than those few vivid memories of checking out the fancy beach craft owned by his father's boss and his first flight with his dad in a Cessna, the rest of what he knows about his father is the result of his own research into his dad's life and the fateful accident in 1967. As he was growing up, his mother remarried, and she didn't talk much to him about his dad. So a great deal of what he knows, he now had to learn on his own.
So, on the day of the accident, they were scheduled to fly from Cleveland, or at least that's where the plane took off from. The plane took off from Cleveland. That's the main international airport that's there now. Was the airport that they departed from. Hopkins International, I think, is the name of it. And they got their weather report, and they both knew that the weather was not going to be favorable flying up into Madison. But there's a thing in aviation that you're warned about during your training. It's something that is known as get-there-itis. Certainly, and this is strictly my opinion, and what I'm saying here in no way reflects, nor is meant to accuse or impugn anybody else's decision on the events of what happened. But certainly, when you're a professional pilot and you're told that you need to get somebody from point A to point B because there's something very important that they have to do, you're going to do everything you can to meet that obligation, because after all, you work for the guy. Okay, so when he's looking at the forecast, he's trying to say, "Well, I think I can do this," but I don't know. I have no idea what his personal limits were. Only he knew that. So ultimately, my father decides, "Well, we can make this trip." But there they went, and as it turned out, and I think I got this from the one preliminary report that I had read. Was that the preliminary investigation showed that the weather had actually gotten worse as they went along, that there were a number of radio calls made from the accident airplane, namely my father, to the various flight service stations along the route about the weather conditions in Madison going in. So he did have some knowledge of the conditions at the time. But usually when you're getting weather reports en route, you're usually just getting ground observations, which are not necessarily going to say anything about the conditions aloft. But he was in contact all the time with the ground as he went along, trying to make sure that he was staying within his limits. But the one thing that happens to a pilot, and it gets back to the get-there-itis, is that as you get closer to your destination, the more you feel like you're going to make it. And again, I wasn't there, but getting back to the whole professional pilot thing and saying, I think I can do this. And so therefore, you start making decisions that try to support your conclusion that you're going to get there. And you know, did he perhaps overlook or minimize some of the reports that he was getting? We don't know. You know, that evidence went down with the plane. But as it turned out, you know, as they were making their approach into Madison, everything seemed to be going fine. There was no indication of trouble as the plane was approaching Madison, but then the contact was lost. And, you know, witnesses on the ground reported hearing, you know, sputtering engine noises, some changes in, you know, the revs, the noise of the engine was variable, and then ultimately the engines quit on them and the plane went down. There was a day when, I didn't even realize, you know, because my mother never really made mention of the remembrance or the occurrence or the anniversary of my father's death. I never really knew exactly what day he died for many years until I got to here to Wisconsin. You know, which I think in some ways is, if you're into karma, if you're into that kind of thing, you know, I live 30 miles from the spot where my father died, but it wasn't because I lived here all my life. You know, I've been a lot of places. One day I was tasked to attend a seminar that was at the at a hotel in Madison on the lakefront. And that day happened to be December 10th. And I came across the local Madison newspaper that had a story about that day in 1967. It was the anniversary of that day. It says, "Holy cow!" You know, not knowing that you know, I had to drive through a slush storm to get to this seminar, and it says, "Holy cow! This is the day my father died," and that was profound. I says, "I got to do something." So after the seminar was over, I went and found a local flower shop. Now, I hadn't been in Wisconsin terribly long, so I did not know my way around Madison like I do now. This was easily, close to 10 years ago. And I went to this flower store and bought a rose. And I knew that, you know, the accident was in Lake Monona, so I decided to drive over to the Monona Terrace Convention Center. So I went over to the Monona Terrace and got as close to the water as I could. And remember, it was a rather crummy day weather-wise. So I was on a promenade in front, and you know, I dropped the flower into the lake. And I told my mother about this later. This was before she passed. And she seemed to be affected by that. She said, "That was a very nice thing that you did." And so it was. And I went back a couple of years later, it wasn't the same year, a couple of years later, and I tried to go up. I'd read about this plaque, and I tried to go up on another anniversary where I happened to be in Madison, and this is, I made a point to do the same thing, another little commemorative thing. And I tried to go up to the roof. It was on one of the roof levels of the convention center, but it was blocked off. It was closed because they didn't plow it or anything. There was snow on the ground, and they didn't maintain that during the winter. So I, you know, it was blocked off from public access, so I couldn't get there. And I says, "There's got to be a better way to, you know, commemorate the day." And it was never my intent, of course, to do anything publicly. I mean, I was hoping that I wouldn't get caught for littering, you know, by dropping a flower into the water, because nobody, you know, who's this guy? You know, I always think people walking by think, you know, who's this guy dropping a rose onto the water? They would have no clue. After my mom died, and this might have been the year my mom died. It was, I guess it was 5 years, so 2004. And of course, losing a parent, time for reflection for sure. And I went and I bought a rose. Actually, I bought two roses, one for my father and one for my mother. And I went down to the waterside, and the lake was frozen over. And I placed the, you know, dropped the roses into the water. And it says, you know, this is the first time in which, you know, if there was a heaven, you both of your spirits are there now. And, you know, that kind of closed a little bit of a chapter there.
The passing of Rich's mother afforded him with an opportunity. He inherited a bit of money through the sale of his mom's house, and he decided to dedicate a portion of that money to flying lessons. With that ride in a Cessna, with his dad offering him the controls when he was just a boy as a source of inspiration, Rich began working towards the pilot's license he has today. Which sort of brings us full circle. Back to that video I found of Rich dropping flowers from a plane over the lake where his father died on December 10th, 1967, and why I was so moved by what I found, and maybe more so by what I didn't find. Before I ever spoke to Rich about his dad, just by searching on the date, I didn't have much trouble at all finding an event that would be significant for my On This Day in Blues history show. Something was widely reported about that day. The death of a celebrity. A young singer died that day when his 7-seat private plane crashed into Lake Monona in Madison, Wisconsin. I found article after article about this incident. Only one article from the time mentioned Rich's dad by name. They all, of course, mentioned the name of the celebrity, his dad's boss. Some of them named the other passengers that were on the plane when it crashed. But I only found one article that named the pilot, Richard Fraser. But the part that really got to me was a more recent article, an article about the placing of a plaque at the site of the crash. There was a picture of the plaque, and its inscription simply read, "This seating area is dedicated to honor the memory of Otis Redding Jr., who lost his life in a plane crash in Lake Monona on December 10th, 1967. While en route to a Madison engagement." It goes on to say that on the morning of the flight to Madison, Redding had been warned about bad weather and was advised to postpone his trip. His loyalty to his Madison fans forced him to proceed. The plaque bears no mention at all of the other 6 people who lost their lives in that crash, and no mention at all of the pilot, Richard Fraser. So I hereby dedicate this edition of Digital Flotsam to the memory of a man who was a pilot, a husband, and a father, who honorably served his country and his boss, and who perished December 10th, 1967, at the age of 26, while trying to get his boss to a gig on time.
Down. So like you won't survive. Like you're lost at sea, watching for that ship to arrive. Even though it's raining and the blues are all around, up there above the clouds, the sun's still shining down on me. The sun's still shining down on me. The sun's still shining down on me,
So there you have it, another episode of Digital Flotsam. I'd like to thank my friend Rich Fraser for both allowing me and helping me to tell the world a little bit about his dad and the circumstances that made him heretofore an anonymous participant in a bit of rhythm and blues history. As always, there will be links to the music you've heard in this episode, along with a few links relating to this story in the show notes at digitalflotsam.org. And, of course, no Digital Flotsam would be complete without Big Al telling us that
P-Dub holded the microphone.